Hello there. For this week's bonus content, we have our interview with a woman named Sandra. A few weeks ago, I was contacted by a pastor here in St. Louis, and he told me that during his undergrad time at Wheaton College in Chicago, he had a professor who was attending Covenant Seminary at the time of Elizabeth's murder. So we looked her up, and she agreed to tell us her story. Sandra was one of the few unmarried female students at Covenant in 1990. And she had a class with Elizabeth, which turned out to be incredibly influential on the rest of her life. She also went to Grace and Peace Church with Agon Middleman, who we've briefly mentioned before in this series. Sandra's story provides a fascinating look into what it was like to be a female student at Covenant Seminary in 1990, and the effect that Elizabeth's murder had on the people that were there. So with that, we bring you Sandra.
When I was attending Covenant, I was Sandra Fullerton. I'll just tell you a little backstory about why I was attending Covenant, because I think it needs a little backstory. I had had, between my graduating from high school and starting at college, I had had a religious experience that I didn't really have a context for understanding, and because I was not really raised in the church. And when I got to Washington University in St. Louis, I joined, I went to an intervarsity meeting, you know, and I walked in the door and they said, "Oh, you know, who are you? Why are you here?" And I said, "Well, I'm a freshman." And I had some kind of religious experience over the summer. And, you know, everybody's eyes just lit up. And when I left that meeting, I had a discipleship partner, a prayer group, and a copy of, you know, John Stott's Basic Christianity. And intervarsity was really important in my discipleship. But I mention this story because as I began to look for a church in the St. Louis area, it was without any sense whatsoever of denominational differences. I did not have that knowledge. And so I just picked a church that I liked, and I liked Grace and Peace quite a bit. I became extremely involved with Grace and Peace. I found it to be just a fantastic community. It was full of intellectuals and artists. It was really a place you could ask questions. In the great Libri tradition, you could ask questions and they were welcomed and people would entertain them and you were treated with respect. And at that time, Agon Middleman was the only pastor. And I not only was involved in the church, I moved into the church neighborhood. I worked as a staff member at the homeless shelter. They did a winter shelter for homeless women. And so I was the Thursday night volunteer for 2 years. I deeply loved that congregation and my small group and Agon. And, you know, that was just a very fruitful place for me. And I grew in my understanding of God and my faith. Now, I never joined Grace and Peace. And I never joined because I always had this kind of intellectual discomfort with some of the inconsistencies that I saw at Grace and Peace. So, for example, Grace and Peace had male elders and wouldn't have female elders, but they were sending out single women as missionaries. And that, to me, just seemed so inconsistent. I thought, what do you think those missionaries are doing? So I really felt uncomfortable with that. Let that be known. And then everybody's like, "Fine, that's why you're not joining, but you're here, you're one of us." And I was welcomed. So when I graduated from college, I was very torn between whether I should go on to graduate school in political science, which was a deep interest of mine, or go on in theology, which was also a great interest. And I loved both, and I couldn't decide. So I decided that since Covenant was close by and associated with my church, that what I would do was I would just get a job in St. Louis, and I would take classes at Covenant part-time while I was working and try and, you know, discern whether that was what I should be doing. So what I did was I enrolled in the Master's in Theology program at Covenant. And let me be explicit here. I never felt any call to ministry. I never was interested in pursuing an MDiv. it was really an intellectual pursuit for me. So I was aware of some of the PCA's position on women, but since I wasn't interested in ministry, I just didn't think it would be an issue. I thought, well, that's not my path.
And Sandra, what year did you start?
1989. So my first class there, I started as soon as I graduated from college. My first class there was in 1989. And with my first class, I realized that things were a little different because, you know, I was coming out of WashU and I had gotten a very, very good education there. And I took a course. My first course was in church history at Covenant. And in that class, it was me and a bunch of young men. And I had an incident with some of the other students in the class, and it was just strange. I can't remember what the professor was talking about, but some theologian, and something in what he said made me ask the question in class, you know, do you think this is related or influenced by the Platonic forms? And the prof and I just had this back and forth about that, you know, we're talking about that. And then we had a break, and I went out to get a drink at the drinking fountain. And these three young men came out, and when I turned around after getting a drink, they were all standing there, and they looked at me, and one of them said, "You're really smart, aren't you?" Just like that, just flat, you know. And I thought, "Oh, okay." I guess somewhere in there, I wasn't supposed to have done what I did, and so, you know, now. Now I would call that a little boundary maintenance. I didn't feel threatened, but my takeaway was that I was strongly discouraged from speaking in class. And look, when I look back at that, I think, yeah, they were really uncomfortable. But I also think that I didn't necessarily take that as all about me, because one thing that had become very clear to me in this class was that I was extremely well educated, and many of these young men were not. You know, they just were not starting from the same place that I was. And so, you know, my goal was not to shame anybody or make anybody feel uncomfortable. I was just trying to learn. So I thought, oh, I can learn without asking questions and making everybody feel uncomfortable. So I will do that. But, you know, my takeaway from that class was, you know, you had to kind of, you know, be careful. So that was the first class I took. And then the second class I took was in the fall of 1989. And I don't remember what the class was, but that was a class with Jerome Bars. And Elizabeth was in it. And she was a breath of fresh air because she sat like in the center. I recall it being in an auditorium, and like she sat in the center about six rows back, and I was sitting in the back corner, and so I could look at her while she was asking questions, and she always asked questions. And it was wonderful because she was just fully engaged, and she asked questions, she'd made comments, she engaged the prof. They had this back and forth. She was smart, she was animated, she was just so engaged in the material. And it was wonderful for me to see her doing that because my feeling was, and at this time I was 21. I was 21 and she was like 50, right? And I thought, well, maybe I read it wrong. Maybe there is this space for me to be an active learner as a woman, to be visible as a woman on this campus because she's doing it. And she really was just so, so engaged, so animated, the ideal student, right? I say as a professor, she was great. So then that was my second class. And Jerome Bars was just very, very, you know, open. He wanted students to talk. He wanted that student engagement in class as well. Then in the spring of 1990, I took a third class, and that class was systematic theology. And I don't remember the name of the professor who taught that, but I do remember that as being quite a negative experience. The professor made us memorize the Westminster Confession. And I thought, fine, But he insisted that we do so in exclusive language. And he said, if you use inclusive language, I'm going to count it off because that is not what the writers intended.
What is exclusive versus inclusive? Like, do you remember what words that would have been?
It's a long time ago, but you couldn't say men and women. You had to say men, you know. Brethren could not be, interpreted as brothers and sisters or, whatever ways that we do that today. He was insistent that we could not do that at the time and that he would mark it incorrect if we used inclusive language. And I thought, fine. If you're going to mark that off, that's fine. I'm here to kind of discern my path. And there's no way I'm writing this in exclusive language. So I memorized it perfectly every time. And I wrote it out perfectly every time. And then I would write a little note, say, I understand your position that you have said that if we use inclusive language, we will be marked off. Yet, I would still choose to use inclusive language because I believe this was written for the church. And I just don't feel like it's appropriate to use other language. And I turned it in every single week. And he never took points off. So I called his bluff. Never took any points off. But beyond that, problem in class, I really struggled really with that class from a spiritual perspective. I was struggling with it, just because of what systematic theology is, kind of taking biblical principles and then deriving other things from them. And Agon, I was really struggling with the class and what I was taking from it. And Agon Middleman, my pastor at the time at Grace and Peace, he was such a help to me. He was such a support. And while I was taking that class, I think Agon was meeting with me like every week. And I also had another former pastor in my small group, Roger, who would meet with me and talk to me about it because I was just struggling so much. And I think that semester was really instrumental in me leaving Covenant for a number of reasons. I think from a theological standpoint, it became clear to me that I do not believe in systematic theology, that I am not Reformed, right? And that came out of that class. But also, Elizabeth was killed. And that happened that semester. And after she was killed, I really did not feel safe at the seminary because I thought, here I had thought things were different. But I think the reality is that my first and third class experiences were more the norm. And I also didn't feel safe because I was involved in the police investigation. And, I had the police calling me and interviewing me and asking me questions about, how I was treated on campus and how, whether anybody was calling my phone and hanging up. And that really made me uncomfortable because here I was trying to discern my path in life. And it just became very clear that following that path, following the path of pursuing a master's in theology or maybe a higher degree in theology might be fraught with conflict and might also just limit my ability in life to contribute. So, that semester, it was so influential. I left Covenant. I went to Los Angeles and I started a graduate program in political science the next fall.
Wow. That sounds like so much to work through as a, 21, 22-year-old. When you decided, do you remember deciding that you needed to leave? Like, what did that feel like?
Well, it was very hard because it was so tied up with Elizabeth's death. And, I remember hearing that Elizabeth died while I was in a small group meeting for my church. We had like a small group breakfast meeting. And I was at this breakfast and I heard there that somebody had been murdered. And I was like, who? And then they said Elizabeth. And I was just thought, I know her. I know her. And it just put a different light on all of my experiences at Covenant. And because here was a woman who clearly had a lot to contribute, right? A lot to contribute, you know, and she had decided that this was her path and it was stopped, right? And I don't know why it was. And I don't know that we're ever going to know why it was, you know, that she was killed. But the fact that she was killed, the fact that she was killed on campus in the chapel building, I don't know, it was like a directional arrow for me, like, not here, go the other way.
Did you have any conversations with other women on campus at the time? There was just a few other female students and wives. Like, was there a sense of like, we're in this together, we're going to keep each other safe? Or were you more just on your own?
I was more on my own because I was a non-traditional student, so I wasn't around during the days, right? So I was taking classes at night and on Saturdays at odd times. And I really didn't have a whole lot of contact with other women at all, other than, you know, Elizabeth, who was in my class.
So Elizabeth is killed in March of 1990. There's still time left in that semester, in that. So you're back on campus, you know, a number of times afterwards. So what was your sense of how was the campus dealing with it? Did professors talk about it? What was that experience like?
I don't remember anything. And in fact, well, you know, it's hard for me to look back on that now, because I think now if we had something like that at a university, I think about all the things that would have happened. And none of those things happened then, you know, like presumably somebody sent me some sort of communication about it. But I remember I only had a mailbox like in a little corner mail room. And so I could only pick up my mail when I went to campus, which was once a week when I went to my class. And I don't remember anybody contacting me from the seminary. All I remember was hearing about it from people in my church who knew people at the seminary. And so that's where I was getting most of my information about her death, was through people at church.
When you say that, for context, I'm an education journalist. And so, you know, I'm pretty familiar with what a university would or should do now when a tragedy happens. Not saying that something in 1990 should automatically be treated the same as something in 24, but is there anything that you wish had happened from like the institution or other students that might have helped you process things differently?
It's hard to say because I don't remember my mindset exactly at that time. I do remember that, you know, what I do remember is I was sitting there with an offer in hand from a graduate school. And I remember that the day I heard that Elizabeth was murdered, I just thought, sign that. Sign that and go. And that is precisely what I did. And I don't remember any communication from the seminary. And, it could be that that was happening in chapel, right, in the chapel sessions. But because I was a part-time student, I just didn't get it. Or I might have gotten a note in my mailbox, but that was pre-email, so there was no way for the seminary to do anything about it other than, you know, maybe send people a letter. And if I got that, I don't know.
But it wasn't like the first class that you had after that, they said, hey, we're just going to talk about this, or?
They did not. No. No. So I felt like I was just really... I feel like most of what I heard through people from my church. And so that was just rumor and gossip.
How has being around that tragedy informed your work since?
Well, this is a strange thing to say about it, because I do think it was a tragedy. And I do think that Elizabeth's death is just the loss of her for the church. You know, this is a woman who was going to work for the well-being of the church. And that loss sits heavily on me. But from my own perspective, the murder was so instructive in my own life. It was like, it really was like, I felt like the path for me was going to get my PhD in political science. that this door was closed. It was just firmly shut, and that was the direction. And that sense of direction that came out of the murder really helped me get through what was an extremely difficult graduate school experience. And a lot of people just took years to complete. And I was like, nope, this is what I should be doing. This is where I have been directed by God. And so I'm going to finish this. And I got in, got out, and have had a very fruitful academic career as a political scientist. So, and you know, it was also my experience at Covenant was helpful to me in discerning my own personal theology. And I would also say when I taught at Wheaton, it was also very helpful for me in conversing with some of my colleagues there. You know, sometimes people would say, oh, well, as a Christian, you have to believe this. And I could say, no. I said, you're saying that because you're Reformed. And so you have followed this thought progression. I am not Reformed. So I am coming from a biblical theological perspective. And so I am in this place. And so that ability that my time at Covenant gave me to be able to explain to people who care deeply about theology, like why we had these differences, that was a gift. That was a gift. And that's something I've used through my life.
I am just kind of soaking in your ability to explain so many multiple facets and sides of both theology, but also like church, and how you've navigated those differences.
I will say, I do not have any bitterness towards the PCA at all, because even though these things happened while I was at the PCA seminary, I was also at my church. And in my church, I was getting so much support, so much you know, they wanted me to be there. They wanted me to have the questions. They wanted me to work through this. They were going to help me in any way they could. And so even though it might have been kind of contentious and difficult at the seminary, there was a way in which every last bit of that was kind of being redeemed and processed within my church community, which was ideal, right? That's what your church is supposed to help you do. And Grace and Peace was just a phenomenal place to be an intellectual.
I've often wondered about, several people have talked to me about the phenomenon of Grace and Peace being a great church, being in St. Louis, and then there being kind of a natural connection to Covenant, and then a push and a pull of exactly what you're describing, of I love this church, I'm confused by this seminary. And some people in the denomination feel it from the opposite way too, of we think Grace and Peace is like way far out in left field, and it's bringing these people to our seminary who aren't Reformed and shouldn't be in the PCA. And so that's kind of a tension in the denomination. I'm also have talked to several people also who were adult converts and have kind of described something similar to you of just wanting to study, wanting to learn. And you didn't necessarily know all of the politics and backstory that you would be jumping into. Have you, since you left, have you had other conversations, maybe at Wheaton, with other adult converts and kind of helped people navigate similar questions?
My husband's an adult convert, and there's a way in which I always felt like if I'm going to have to marry an adult convert. Just because we have very, very different views, right, about what is going on at any particular point in time. And you're not carrying around a whole lot of baggage, right? Or your baggage is other, different. But I have not found, you know, he has just had a different set of questions than I have had. So, and maybe a different set of concerns or not a need to kind of probe deeply into why are things the way they are. And I think my theology, this problem that I had, not being able to determine whether I wanted to go to graduate school in theology and political science, is because the same kinds of issues are often at play in both of these things, right? That what we believe about theology or what we believe about government affects our polity, affects how we are together as people. And so I don't know. That's not quite answering your question, Ruth, but I don't know that I have had, I can't think of anybody else I know who's an adult convert who then went to seminary.
When you were at Grace and Peace and Covenant, did you have a sense of like, oh, Grace and Peace is like this black sheep of PCA churches in St. Louis? Or was it kind of like, this is the only experience you know? So that was the water you were swimming in?
Well, it was the water I was swimming in. And then I went to Covenant. And then people would say, oh, Grace and Peace, what's going on over there? And I would say, good things. But yeah, I definitely, when I was at Covenant, I definitely got the feeling that the church was something of a pariah. But it was also very hard to figure out why that was, given that the church was doing so much that was good. And, you know, whenever you start talking to people at Covenant, they start, you know, invoking LaBrie. And I'm like, have you been to Grace and Peace, right? That is your most like LaBrie place. And so I think it's all nice to think about LaBrie in the abstract. But when you think about what was it like to have people show up and question, people who weren't necessarily going to believe everything that you thought and, you know, toe the line. Well, I mean, that was Grace and Peace.
I looked up your CV. You have a lot of expertise in human rights. And I was just curious how your faith and your time at Covenant together or separately inform that work.
Well, it's always hard for me to figure out how my faith impacts my work, because I kind of became a Christian at the same time that I became interested in these issues that I have spent my life working on. And so it's hard for me to pull those apart.
Can you just elaborate just briefly, what is that work for the audience who hasn't read your CV?
Sure. So I do work on forced migration, on property rights, and on sort of post-conflict community reconstruction. What happens to places where there's been war? At least that's my recent work. I have done some other work in the past looking at how courts function, how well they function, particularly adjudication of property conflicts or post-genocidal work. So yeah, I'm in this human rights world. I would not say that's my most, my work definitely lines up with that. I would say that I'm a political economist, that I study property rights and post-conflict reconstruction.
So less about the conflict itself and more about society afterward.
Afterwards, and how do you go putting the pieces back together? So, but I do think that that's impacted by my faith. Yeah, I do, because I'm and perhaps also by the Reformed tradition, right? The idea that our lives should be spent making things new, reforming them, making systems better. That's more Reformed than it is necessarily Anabaptist, my current tradition. So maybe I have been significantly influenced. I don't know. I also have a great deal of dear friends, a number of dear friends who are Reformed and talk to me about it all the time. So hard to sort of pull apart their influence on my life from that of Covenant.
Well, thanks for entertaining the question. But I saw Kosovo and I saw Uganda and I think Rwanda, and I just thought it was fascinating. So thanks for sharing. TJ, is there anything else that y'all talked about that we should bring in?
There was one, you mentioned something about a story of that systematic theology class, something about, and because the word prelapsarianism stood out to me.
Oh, okay. Yes, I will. I'll tell you the story and then you can figure it. I didn't realize I told you that story. Yeah, that in my systematic theology class, one of the things that was pretty influential in my decision, in my understanding that I just was not Reformed and that I simply did not accept systematic theology, was that the professor was talking about the fall, and he said he was talking about prelapsarianism, and he says, your belief about this is just as important as your belief in Christ. And I thought, no, 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 no. And how have you gotten yourself into this place? You
know, I just thought, for anybody who's made it this far and doesn't know what prelapsarianism is, can you give a sentence?
Well, are you saved before the fall, right? Being saved before the fall, right? And I just think, no, it's just simply not as important that as to whether you believe in Jesus Christ is not. And that was when it was actually talking to Aegon about that. And Aegon and I think at that point we had like a regular meeting. Like I would go to class and then the next day I would go and talk to Aegon. I would say, Aegon, what the heck? How could this be? And Aegon said, well, Sandra, maybe you just don't believe in systematic theology. But for me, that was a little bit of a revelation, right? Because I didn't know. I didn't know that there were other options. I sort of thought that that's what I had to be. And Aegon said, no, you could believe in biblical theology and just not believe that you can draw any of these other secondary conclusions. And he was like, oh, it's like a wave of peace rolling over me, thinking, okay, good. So I'm still okay, even though I don't believe in any of this. And that was funny because when I went to, when I later worked at Wheaton, and I would have a chat with the theologians. And I remember one of them saying, well, you know, I can't remember. He was talking to me about some sort of derivative principle. And I said, yeah, you believe that. I don't, you know, because that is coming from systematic theology. And I just don't think we need to make any other suppositions about what God meant through scripture other than what is in scripture. So I am a biblical theology person.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thanks for bringing me into it, both of you. Is there anything that we haven't talked about yet that you want to make sure to bring up?
No, I would just, you know, repeat the fact that in my own life, you know, although this was a terrible event, and although I would not attend a PCA church, I don't really bear any ill will against the PCA, because when I think about the PCA, I also think so much about my precious brothers and sisters at that church. And so while my experience at Covenant was negative, my experience in the church was so positive that it like grabbed me and kept me in and kept me in the faith. And I think insulated me from Elizabeth's murder being more influential in my life or pulling me away from the faith somehow. And I'm grateful for that.